We will be right back. Don't go away.
Everybody, we're live.
Hello.
I am happy tonight because I just, for the first
got
time,
got on the phone with us.
Well,
that's
of
what
course.
Happened.
That's obviously the reason. It's definitely not that I finally found decent barbecue brisket on Long Island.
It's been
a journey.
You now sort of kind of owe me a visit. I think you visited. You might be even up in lifetime visits, but you should come visit me at some point. And we have several barbecue spots in Richmond that I genuinely think are quite good. Not to say they're better than what you've got or anything like that, but they're very good.
They're almost certainly better than what we've got.
No, all right.
Barbecue
tends to
get better the further south you go in the United States.
Well, that is true, yeah. But I'm trying to be inclusive here. But
it's the opposite of coffee.
In any case, I'd love to take you to a couple of local haunts that I don't think I was aware of the last time you were here, because it's been a minute since you've been down here. So if you're looking for a barbecue adventure, you let me know. You can come visit here. And now at this point, all the North Carolinians and Tennesseans are all getting angry and saying Virginia is not for barbecue, and you're wrong. That's okay.
It's better than New York, I'll tell you that.
I mean, I bet you there's some really good spots in New York City, for example, and you're not that far.
The problem with barbecue is it takes so much time and space to do right that it really...
That is true.
It doesn't really fit into like a... Lots of things you can do if you just have like a hole in the wall and, you know, a place to do it and just someone who's dedicated to it. But barbecue is just such... There's so much... I mean, so much... time and smoke, right? Like it just
it's a special
doesn't fit well
like,
in the city.
You need special equipment, you need it's a very like specialized dedicated stuff just to make this kind of product.
And mm-hmm. So it doesn't fit in an urban environment that well.
That's true.
Like, because of all the time and the smoke and the heat and the
I mean, people do it, just not a lot of people, and it's not very good.
Yeah. I mean, it's the type of thing. It's the same thing with like, oh, why can't we get good pizza outside of New York? And so people who knew how to make good pizza would go to other parts of the country. And you can, like, you don't need that much space for it. You can just, you know, get a little restaurant and get the right ingredients and do it right. But I think barbecue is more difficult. And also, I don't think the market for it's that big. Like, people like pizza everywhere, but barbecue is more of a specialized taste, I feel like.
I both agree and disagree. I think any person that likes tasty food could enjoy barbecue, but
I'm not saying they wouldn't like it. They just don't know that they,
that's
you know what I mean? Like they don't know that they don't seek it out because they think what barbecue is whatever. I don't even know what they think it is, but they don't know what it actually is. So
they think
have no
it's
reason
just
to
a
seek
cookout.
It out.
Like most people think barbecue is meat cooked on a grill, which is
right, exactly.
Not, we're talking about like
not
slow smoked meat. This is it's not even the same food. Like it. But yeah, I mean, it's probably like barbecue is really unhealthy for lots of reasons. Like, you know, all the wood smoke is full of carcinogens and you're eating huge amounts of fatty meats. So like it's not something that you should have like as easy. I mean, I know pizza's no gem in the health realm either, but I think it's less bad than barbecue.
I don't know about that. I genuinely don't know. But
depends,
I feel
what,
like,
what's going to kill you. If you're going to die of cancer, barbecue is probably worse. If you're going to die of high cholesterol, pizza's probably worse.
Right, exactly.
Neither one should be a huge part of anybody's diet.
For what it's worth, Neil__ in the chat says that they went to ZZQ, which is one of my favorite spots here in town, and they can confirm that it was quite good. So there you go. You should come visit. All right, let's do some follow-up. Very, very quickly, a service I provide to you, the audience, is that I mention the once a month or two, that Apple releases new immersive content on the Vision Pro. There is a new immersive video, Man vs. Beast. This is about rodeo. Speaking of things that are perhaps Southern or maybe that the three of us are not very familiar with, I was thinking about it. We don't need to belabor this, but I think one of the things I really love about this series and the videos that Apple's put out, immersive videos that Apple's put out, is that a lot of them are exposing me to different activities and sports and whatnot that I'm just deeply unfamiliar with, which I think is really neat. And this was, again, rodeo. It was filmed a lot at night, which to my recollection, not a lot of what we've seen so far was filmed at night. A lot of it was in very bright daylight, which obviously lends itself to be filmed pretty well and pretty easily. But this was really good. It was 10 minutes, not, you know, do or die, but it's worth checking out. So if you have a Vision Pro or have access to one and friend with one or whatever the case may be, go have a look. Man versus Beast. We'll put a link in the show notes. I don't remember where this came from. I don't think this was an original composition of mine, but last episode we were talking about my LED project, which is sort of kind of, but not really, on hold. I think I'm going to have more news about that in the future, but not tonight. But that being said, I referred to the fact that the Historical Commission had denied my application for modifying my home. And there were several people that wrote in. John T. wrote, Casey mentioned a historical commission had prevented him from adding three LEDs to an existing blanked off outlet. Did he also mention his house is late 1990s? I'm confused about the historical commission involvement. To be absolutely clear, I'm talking about Aaron. I was trying to be kind about it, but yeah, I'm talking about it, Aaron.
This is a long-running joke on our show that the Historical Commission approving things in our house is just our spouses being okay them in our house. Like, that's just...
In fact, I might have stolen it from you, Marco. I think you might have
totally
been
did. It was a Marco thing. It was originally when he was talking about potentially getting a low-profile Marantz receiver for his entertainment center, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right.
How do you remember that? Well done.
I'm impressed.
That's where it came from.
John listens to
you remember
show.
Too, but...
Yeah, because John listens back to the show. That's the difference.
Yeah, no, that was many, many years ago, and Marco... If Marco got it from somewhere, I don't know, but I heard it first from Marco, referring to his wife as the Historical Commission, because she had specific demands about what kind of electronic products were and were not allowed in the entertainment center. And Casey has adopted that and then quickly forgot where it came from. So no,
I redeemed myself. Well, I halfway redeemed myself. Thank you very much. Right. I award myself half credit. And actually, sort of tangentially speaking of, my terminal has shipped. I will state for the record that Marco paid with his own dollars for his terminal, but the terminal people were kind and offered to send John and myself units. So I did not pay for this. We will probably talk about it in the future on the show, but mine has shipped, and I believe I told Aaron that there's something forthcoming, but I haven't said too much about it. I think I described it as an auto-updating version of the calendar that we have on our refrigerator. So I'm curious to hear what the Historical Commission has to say about this when it shows up. We shall see. All right. We had talked, I think I had brought this up last episode when we were talking about Sonos. I had parroted something that I had heard many, many, many times, but I couldn't tell you where I first began hearing this. And honestly, it might have been Reddit, which is not a good sign. But I had said that in the new version of the app, which I had colloquially dubbed S3, the volume changes when you change the volume in a speaker. It has to round trip across the internet to like some central warehouse at Sonos or something like that, and then come back to your house in order to affect your speakers. An anonymous listener wrote in and said, that's a rumor that won't die because it feels right to people when they see that volume changes are slow. There are things that do go through cloud services that didn't before, like account management and some other stuff, but not volume. So I am dead wrong about that, apparently.
I tried to save you last show, but I couldn't definitively do it. So I just waved you off as best I could. But now we have a definitive answer. Volume changes do not go to a server and back.
Then they should be faster. But that's neither here nor there.
I actually did get an explanation of why they're slow, and it's not satisfying. But suffice it to say, there's no server involved.
So this was sent privately to you then? Because I don't remember seeing this feedback.
Yes.
Okay. Well, feel free to privately forward that to me because I'm curious now, but that's okay. DeepSeek censorship. Matthew Cave writes, it's not really running locally that removes the Chinese political correctness. It's running a sufficiently abbreviated model. The models that you would run locally have reduced numbers of parameters. I can only assume that the rules enforced by the Chinese government have sufficiently low priority that they are eliminated somewhere between the 70 billion parameter model and 32 billion parameter model. I am not an expert on how these things work. My vocabulary is very likely wrong.
And pausing there for a second, I'm not an expert either, but I also don't, I'm not sure that reducing the number of parameters would so radically change the behavior. But anyway, continuing
from Matthew, if you ask the 32 billion parameter model politically sensitive questions, you get remarkably astute and well thought out answers. If you supply the exact same prompt to the 70 billion parameter model, you get the roadblocks. Quote, Taiwan has always been an inalienable part of China, quote, or let's talk about something else, or we have always been at war with East Asia. For local machines,
this looks like Winnie the Pooh.
For local machines with sufficient RAM, I found the 32 billion model to run acceptably fast and to be surprisingly complete. 70 billion is even more capable if you have the RAM to run it, but is significantly slower and, as mentioned, has the roadblocks in place. You can also spot answers that are short-circuited by one of these override type rules, as they have no think blocks, or rather, the think block is completely empty. This is the block at the top of most answers that exposes the quote-unquote reasoning of the model. For the overrides, it's a hard-coded answer. There's no reasoning. Again, these overrides seem to be eliminated in the 32 billion model and smaller.
So I confirmed with Matthew that he did actually run both the 32 billion and the 70 billion locally to discover this. And it seems super weird to me because, like, Daniel Jalkut, I guess, ran the 32 billion one. He's like, hey, if you run it locally, you don't get these things. And I was surmising that it was a layer they put on the server. But I guess somehow it's in the 70 billion parameter model, but not the 32. It's so weird. Like, trying to censor this is a losing battle, but, you know, they do what they can. But it's just weird that they're distributing the weights and the smaller set of them either doesn't have the political censorship or it's like malfunctioning, but the big one does. Anyway, there you have it. Censorship, it's weird and futile, and although people will say, that's what everyone said about the Great Wall of China, like not the actual wall, but the Great Firewall of China, like it would be impossible to keep the internet out, and somehow the Chinese government does it. I guess they sort of kind of do. But anyway, they're trying to do the same with their model, but when you run it locally, I guess if you use the smaller model, you don't have to deal with that.
We got a bunch of feedback with regard to Marco's question about Docker, which I don't think I said this on the show last week, but I was very proud of you for asking that question. And if you ignore all of the feedback, I'm pleased that you're investigating. So that makes me happy. But Brian Ryder writes in, you can indeed use Rosetta on Docker on Apple Silicon. There are some gotchas. Some technologies that themselves use a VM will crash, specifically some versions of Lua and I think LaTeX stuff. Also, older versions of SQL Server on Linux. However, by and large, the whole thing works astonishingly well. Consider the horrifying case of SQL Server on x86 64 Linux on Docker on an M3 Max. This is notably faster than my sad and idle Intel i9 dev machine with no downside that I've experienced. Under the hood, there's a very minimal Linux virtual machine running in the hypervisor.framework that hosts the Docker stuff and a bunch of magic to obscure this. You may need to twiddle resources allocated to the VM to make stuff go, such as overcoming the Linux OOM killer or for performance reasons.
Yeah, there's something a bunch of people wrote in, probably either Windows or Linux users, saying Docker is not a VM. There's no VM involved. That's true if you're running Docker on Linux. Like, that's part of the magic of it, is it just kind of like exposes the actual Linux kernel you're running on, but fences off the processes so they think they're in their own machine and can't see other stuff, yada, yada. But of course, when you're on the Mac, even though it's Unix-based, it's not Linux. So Docker on the Mac does have to run one minimal Linux VM under the covers, and then it runs all the containers on top of that VM. In practice, it's all transparent. You don't have to worry about this, but it's just an implementation detail because macOS may be officially certified Unix if they still have that certification, but Linux is not Unix, and GNU is not Unix. I don't know. Lots of recursive acronyms in there, but yeah, Linux is a little bit different.
Indeed. Then additionally from Brian Ryder, with regard to Docker versus something else, having used Docker Desktop for several years, I recently switched to OrbStack. And quick aside, we've heard a lot of feedback with regard to OrbStack, all positive.
Literally everyone has told us. Like, and I don't mean everyone who's written in or everyone who, you know, we heard from this week. I literally mean everyone in the world has told us about OrbStack. So thank you, literally everyone.
We did discuss Orbstack on a show a while ago. I remember because I tried it because I think I had mentioned Docker ages ago and someone said, you should try Orbstack. So I did. And it was fine. At the time, I decided it was not better enough for me to forego Docker Desktop, but I'm sure it's gotten better since then. And yeah, lots of people recommend it.
Man who compiles from source is unimpressed with a layer
that's,
on top
that's
of Docker.
That's not why. I'll finish reading Brian's feedback and I'll explain my reasoning.
All right, let me just start it over since we got ourselves sidetracked. So having used Docker Desktop for several years, I recently switched to Orbstack. While not free, it is much more well integrated with the macOS experience and Finder. It automatically creates an HTTPS reverse proxy for any container that listens on TCP port 80. It has a very useful debug shell for containers. And finally, it has a way to pick one or more Linux distributions to integrate with your shell in the style of Windows subsystem for Linux. While I'm using Mac ports, this feature is probably a viable drop-in replacement for Mac ports or Homebrew to give you your preferred full Linux environment for ad hoc CLI stuff instead of installing native Unix packages on macOS.
Yeah, I think the idea is like instead of, you know, like I said, instead of installing like whatever your favorite command line tool is using some Mac package manager, you can install it inside Linux and just use it from your Mac command line as if it was installed on your Mac. But it's not. It's all the evil is confined to containers. That's something you'll see with Docker. We always talk about like, oh, Docker, it's like a little virtual machine or, you know, a little imaginary machine, if not an actual virtual machine. But you can distribute single command line things as Docker containers. They're lightweight enough where you might say like, oh, I don't want you to have to figure out all of the Python crap that you have to have installed to run my Python script. So I've just made a container with my little Python script and all the stuff, and you can run it as a command and it will run it in from the container. The reason I didn't go with Orbstack back in the day was, I mean, the features that it had, like this way of running commands inside the Linux thing or integration with the Mac, with the automatic listening and stuff like that, I didn't need at that point because I'd already done all that with plain old Docker. And my philosophy was with stuff like this is like, when possible, stick to the official thing. Because if I ever have any problems, which I have occasionally, when I like Google for an answer, it's easier to find answers for just plain Docker or the official Docker on macOS than it is to find answers for Orbstack. It's just one more layer between me and figuring out what's broken, right? And like I said, I'd already done everything I needed to do with Docker Desktop. And I haven't regretted that decision. I've just, you know, Docker Desktop updates frequently. And, you know, it's presumably they're fixing bugs and improving performance. But as far as I'm concerned, I just run the auto updates and it just continues to work. So I've been fine with it. But just please know that everyone who has tried Orbstack seems to love it, except for me.
Then you had mentioned somewhat offhandedly, John, sending email from Docker. We got some fascinating feedback. I had no idea this was a thing, although it makes perfect sense. We got a triplet or a trio of different pieces or different suggestions. Matt Barlow writes, last episode, John mentioned not having worked out how to send emails from his Docker setup yet. I've found MailHog to be a great way to deal with this, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Stand it up alongside your PHP and MySQL containers, and then you can send email to it as if it were any other SMTP server. It then exposes a Gmail-style web front end to view the emails. Very cool stuff. John Caruso writes, I've been using a tool called MailPit, and again, put a link in the show notes, for when I don't actually want to send mail to anyone, but I do want to verify that it's still working and looks correct. Finally, Yves Serrano writes, for mail testing, I use a mail dev container in my Docker Compose stack. Link in the show notes.
Yeah, these are all ways to essentially not send mail. Like you want to send somewhere so you can look at it, but it's not actually sending email to an address. So if you send mail to like, you know, johnsmith@gmail.com, whatever you send the to address to, it's all going to go into the mail hog or the mail pit or whatever. Like it's not going to actually go to johnsmith@gmail, right? It's going to go to these, and then you can just look at it using a web interface. Or you can do what I did and just print it to the error log and look at it there.
Very John answer. Bram Esposito writes, the easiest way to have configurable and reproducible environments for PHP is using ddev.com. It runs on top of Orbstack, there we go, and is very easy to extend. It has HTTPS certificates, networking mail pit, and all pre-configured, so you can just start using it right away. Sounds like a good fit for what Marco's looking for, not having tried it myself.
Well, so many people have also pointed out, which I believe you also did, Casey, that you know to go fully into the Docker lifestyle, I would really want to have the advantage of also running these same containers on the servers. And so I think the more I dive into like these specialized tools, and to be fair, I don't know if this tool does this or not, but like I don't want necessarily something that is just going to optimize for a dev environment or just going to optimize for like Macness. what I want ideally is closer to what John was saying of like as much of like the big official tools as possible. And ideally, if I can ship the same dock to the container, if I can ship the same thing to the servers, then that's really interesting to me.
Here's the thing, like I like I said last time, the whole idea behind Bakker is that, you know, if it works on my computer, fine, we'll ship your computer. Like that's what we'll run, is how the place where you develop it is the thing that we deploy it on. But I think what might appeal to you, Marco, is the easier, more straightforward debuggability of a plain production server that you presumably already have. You know what I mean? You're not starting from zero, right? If there's something wrong on your production server, the ability to hop in there and just mess around and do stuff without having to worry about Docker is probably more straightforward to you than learning how to correctly hop into a Docker container and figure out what it's like. It's, again, it's another layer of stuff to deal with. If you were starting from zero, I'd say, well, then, and you're willing to learn Docker stuff, then fine. But I think probably the path of least resistance is to leave your production servers the way they are, just plain old servers with files in them that you know how to deal with. And if there's a problem there, you can tackle it the way you always do. And then make your dev environment look as much like that as possible. And no, you don't get the advantage of like, well, I'm sure it's exactly the same because my dev environment is my production environment. It's just my container and I run my container. And that is a better way to do it overall. But the specific situation you're in where you already have a production server that's already not Docker, it's not that hard to make a Docker container that looks pretty much exactly like that, that still gives you the easy debuggability. And then, by the way, Orbstack mentioned they have like a debug shell or whatever. That's stuff like that is stuff that the official Docker desktop has added recently. What they mean is like, you don't have to install all your debug tools in your Docker container because like, what should I put in my container? Well, I want Emacs in there and I want strace and I want, like, you think like, I need all these tools, but then you're making your container bigger and bigger because they're just like, when I'm in that container, I want all my stuff. Well, you can make the container very slim and then also make it so you can hop into the container and debug it and bring with you a bundle of your debugging tools just when you're debugging it. But if this sounds complicated to you, this is why I'm suggesting it's probably less fraught, especially for production stuff, if you're not totally on board of learning this, to just leave your production server the way it is, emulate it, like, you know, make a dev environment that matches that, and then just do it that way. So your Mac stays clean, you have a repeatable dev environment, your dev environment is exactly matched to your server. You control both of them because the server is not going to update to PHP 8 unless you do it. And if you update the server to PHP 8, you can update your container to PHP 8. Now, if you're willing to go on board and say, I'm going to do Docker everywhere, you can do that, but just know that there is a learning curve to how do I run and debug Docker containers versus how do I run and debug a bunch of files in the file system on my Linux server, which is, I'm assuming, what you're used to.
Yeah.
Then finally, with regard to Docker, let me try that again. Hello.
Pronunciation's right in there, man.
I know, but I put a W.
I like the little trap on the last name.
Yeah, seriously.
Just say it like it's spelled.
It'll be fine. All right, let me try that all again. Hello and goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
Finally, with regard to Docker, Devault Renecki writes, if you're only going to use Docker images for development, you should have a look at development containers or dev containers, which is at the URL containers.dev, because, yeah. Anyways, it adds a JSON file to your repo, but the best part is the integration with many editors. I use Visual Studio Code and it works great, or use the CLI tool. The editor will detect the dev container setup in your repo, build the images, link up the source files on your Mac to the container, map the ports, run all your setup commands, scripts, etc., and all of that. My repos are all set up with this. On a brand new Mac, I simply need Docker Desktop installed, and then when I open the local folder or repo in my locally running editor, it builds and runs everything so slick.
Yeah, there's lots of these things that are integrated with like Visual Studio Code in particular, which again is not going to help Marco if he wants to use TextMate or whatever, but lots of these things are like, you know, we'll put some files in there and your IDE will see the files and figure out that it wants to run stuff in containers and run them all. And we didn't mention this last time, but like people keep mentioning Docker Compose, which is a way to make like a set of Docker containers that together make your app, because you've got one for a database server and one for a load balancer and one, like, you're trying to, like, you know, if you're going to deploy seven different containers to production because you have all these different components, you also have them as containers on your dev machine and you don't want to kind of orchestrate them all yourself. So you can bring them all up as a unit so they're all talking to each other, which is another complication that I think, I don't know how like Overcast web situation goes, but the ATP web stuff is so simple that everything is in one container and I don't have to deal with this at all, but know that Docker can do it with Docker Compose. And there are other systems that can also run containers that get increasingly complicated. But yeah, a lot of people just assumed like, well, if you've got a web server and database, surely you're running two different containers. Nope. They're both in the same container. They're also both in the same machine.
Where do you think the ATP server setup script came from?
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, like, everyone assumes that, like, everything is, like, big, fancy production where you've got a fleet of servers, and I've been in that world, but in, you know, to run, for example, ATP.fm, you don't need that, right? To run Rovercast.fm, maybe you do. You tell me, but, like...
I mean, yeah, I usually maintain, like, 8 to 12 web servers, but it's... They're all each very simple, and...
They're all simple, yeah. The complication of quote-unquote real production web development at scale is so... It's huge. There's just a huge amount to know and do. It's extremely complicated. And I think people who are in that world think, like, well, surely for ATP.fm, you're running Kubernetes. And it's like, no, I'm not. Like, it's just nothing. Whatever you think we're doing, it's not that. You don't need to do that for simple scenarios. And it really does simplify things. Like, the amount of stuff I no longer have to worry about working on a tiny website versus the massive one that I was working on at my jobby job is just so refreshing and so nice. And I would not give that up in exchange for being able to say that I use some cool new technology and open up a fleet of Docker containers that all coordinate with each other to run what is mostly a static website.
All right. Unrelated to Docker, we have feedback with regard to Marco's mostly offhanded comment about your TV audio being completely out of sync. We have a listener named Marco Arment who wrote, if you're having trouble with audio sync from your Apple TV to an external soundbar sound system, turn on the match format and match dynamic range in the Apple TV's video settings. I don't know why this makes a difference on my LG C7 OLED, but it really, really does. In particular, the Apple TV / LG C7 combo appears to have different audio output delay depending on whether the output is Dolby Vision, HDR, or not. So if you calibrate it for one format, it'll be wrong for the other. Except if the Apple TV is set to match content, match dynamic range, which for whatever reason suddenly makes the sync perfect.
Yeah, this has been driving me nuts. Ever since we upgraded, when we moved to Long Island, we upgraded that TV sound system from a Sonos amp with giant floor speakers that I have since given away to other family members. Wanted like a smaller setup here, so I got a Sonos Arc soundbar, and it has been a nightmare trying to get the Sonos Arc soundbar to line up with anything that the TV was doing with audio. And I mentioned in the past, like, I'd asked John about apps to look at TV audio sync and stuff, and no matter what I did, I could not. And I tried the built-in Apple TV wireless audio sync thing. I tried the function built into the TV itself. I tried using both in combination with each other, and nothing I did could get the audio sync right on every video format. So instead, a few days ago, I tried that setting, and I still couldn't get it right on the Sonos Arc. I still, no matter what, I could not get it right. And I thought, you know, in the old setup from the old house, I never had sync problems. Let me try bringing out that Sonos amp from my closet and just plug in some regular passive speakers to it and see if that works. And with those settings, and only with those settings, it is flawless. So
I'm surprised you have such problems with the Arc. Because my Arc, I think I did have to tweak the delay once in settings. But regardless of if I'm using the Switch or the Apple TV, it's always been consistent for me. Now I have an LG. It's a C3. No, C9.
C9. Yeah, yours.
It was
a
2019 model.
So maybe the problem is, like, every combination of, like, input device and TV could have different sync problems and soundbar. Like, all three of those are all. And maybe we'll get to this later. Like, all three of those are trying to give you one coherent experience where the video and audio line up, and it's a hard problem, especially with the complexity of all these devices these days and all the different processing they're doing at all the different stages. But the result was I could not get the Sonos Arc to be in sync with my oldish LG TV at all, whereas the Sonos amp, which is a kind of a simpler product, the Sonos amp did it just fine, and it's flawless with speakers, with passive speakers, only with those settings turned on. So there we go.
Yeah, and as I said on the Mastodon when you posted this, you should have those settings on anyway, because I highly recommend them, because they mean that your television is showing the content the way the content is. So if the content is 24 frames per second, your television should be refreshing at some multiple of 24 frames per second and not converting it from 24 to 30 so then it can display it at 60 or whatever. Basically, you don't want your TV messing with it, right? If the content is HDR, your TV should be HDR. If the content is SDR, your TV should be SDR. And that's what match content and match dynamic range and those settings do. Now, the reason people don't like those settings, as everyone said when they replied to you on Mastodon, is because they cause sometimes horrendous delays when changing from one piece of video to another, or when changing from video back to the menu, because no matter what you pick, like, your Apple TV menu to be in, and you can pick, like, I want my menus to be in, you know, 30 frames per second, HDR, Dolby, like, that's just, like, what do you want, when you see the little squares, what do you want that to be shown in? Whatever you pick for that, if you watch anything that is not exactly that, your TV's like, oh, time to match dynamic range, time to match content, and makes your screen black, and you have to count one, two, three, however many seconds, then it comes back. And people are particularly annoyed, like, with YouTube. Like, I don't know if it's a YouTube app that's built into TVs or the official YouTube app on Apple TV, but if you're watching YouTube TV stuff, whenever there's an ad, the ad might be in a different dynamic range and frame rate than the thing you're watching. So every time there's an ad, your screen goes black, and you wait a few seconds, and it shows the ad, and then you wait a second, and it's just, it's untenable, right? Back in November of 2022 on ATP episode 507, we talked about, I think for the first time,
John's QMS, bringing receipts, y'all.
Yeah, QMS or quick media switching, which was supposed to solve this, but at the time, it wasn't out on a lot of televisions. And also, this technology only helps you when the thing that changes is just frame rate. So if you change from SDR to HDR, you're still screwed. But if you're just changing frame rate, it uses the television's VRR variable or refresh rate capability to not black out the screen and wait 5 seconds. And finally, someone posted, named Nit on Mastodon posted a YouTube video of quick media switching in action on their TV. It's great. Totally seamless. There's no blackout. It's real nice. I wish it did it for SDR versus HDR too, but I would love to have this. I don't think it's on my TV. I don't think there's been a firmware update or whatever. I just deal with the blackouts just because, like, for me, I switch content way less frequently than I watch content. So, you know, to watch a thing, yes, I will have to watch a black screen. I wait, a thing comes on. But then I watch a show for an hour or half an hour, right? So that 3 seconds of switching and blackness is worth it for the hour I get to watch the show correctly in the correct format. Other people have different trade-offs, especially if you're watching YouTube TV and it has ads in it and it's driving you up a wall. So I believe, speaking on both these issues, I believe the new version of HDMI has a bunch of new features related to, certainly related to trying to wrangle audio sync better than the current standards do. Like, you'll see on lots of devices, they have some feature that says automatically manage audio sync using, like, HDMI 2.1s or 2.0s features. Those don't always work that well, as Marco found out. Hopefully, whatever they're doing in HDMI 2.2 does a better job of that. And then the other thing is, I don't know if HDMI 2.2 brings anything to help with quick media switching or if it enhances it to deal with HDR versus SDR. But at the very least, if you were to buy a TV today, chances are very good that it will support quick media switching and will save you at least from frame rate switches.
Cool. All right, let's do some topics. And may I invite you to join me on this endeavor? So there is a new app called Apple Invites, obviously written by Apple. And let me read to you from Apple's official announcement, or excuse me, is this from The Verge? What is the providence for this, John?
I think that's the press release, right?
Is it the press release? All right. Moving on. All right. So Apple today, on the February 4th, introduced Apple Invites, a new app for iPhone that helps users create custom invitations to gather friends and family for any occasion. With Apple Invites, users can create and easily share invitations, RSVPs, contribute to shared albums, and engage with Apple Music playlists. Starting today, users can download Apple Invites from the App Store or access it through the web at iCloud.com/invites. iCloud Plus subscribers can create invitations, and anyone can RSVP regardless of whether they have an Apple account or Apple device. Participants can easily contribute photos and videos to a dedicated shared album within each invite to help preserve memories and relive the event. And collaborative playlists allow Apple Music subscribers to create curated event soundtracks that guests can access right from Apple Invites.
So first, we just have to acknowledge that it really annoys some people that invite, which is a verb, has been nouned instead of saying invitations, because invitations is too long. They say invites. That's the name of the app. It's not Apple Invitations. It's Apple Invites. As language changes, just got to deal with it as much as it pains me in some other instances. This one I can tolerate, but it does look better on underneath an app icon. The second thing is, why is Apple doing this?
I feel like there's like two interns at Apple who get to build an app like every 3 or 4 years, and that's how you get stuff like Clips or Music Memos and now Invites. And it's like, these are all like apps that could serve a purpose and could take off in the market, but they never put any follow through behind these apps. They always get like one or two updates and then die forever, and just never, they just get memory hold. They never get mentioned again. No one ends up using them. They get no traction. So, you know, like, I think Apple's record with apps like this is even worse than like Google's record of killing all their like web service experiments. It's like, I'm sure this is a wonderful app, maybe, but why would anyone assume this would still be here in 6 months? Based on Apple's traffic record, I have no idea.
Yeah, this is some anonymous snark that we got regarding this is, can't wait for this to wither on the vine just like Journal and Clips.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, so setting that aside, I've actually used the app. And it doesn't look like it was made by interns. It is fairly fancy and sophisticated. It looks a lot like, if you watch a lot of WWDC videos where they do demo apps, imagine the type of app that would be an Apple demo app at WWDC, but like completed and polished, right? Very much in the same kind of style and vibe where they would describe like, let's do this and let's make this here and show this and
birds.
Let's have a nice background. Right. Everything is a rounded rectangle and everything has pretty backgrounds on it or whatever. And I have to say, like, as an example of, I mean, it's hard to pin this all on app, but like Apple makes so few new apps. As an example of like, this is what Apple thinks a good iOS app should look like. Kind of like with system settings in the Mac, I'm not sure I agree with them. It is pretty and polished, but having used it for its intended purpose, I, you know, made a fake Super Bowl party and invited people to it. And then
that's exactly what I did.
Had them, you know, it's the time of year. So it's a good time, right? To try the app out. I feel like just the information architecture and visual hierarchy makes it more difficult than it needs to be to use the app in a utilitarian way. Like, when it comes to stuff like this, you just want it to work, and you want just the facts, and you don't want anything getting in the way. And as cute as it is to have a nice background and a playlist and all these shading and rounded rectangles, I found it to be visually noisy in something that I want to be straightforward. Like, consider the difference between an app like this and something like Apple's Calendar or Google Calendar or something like that. Calendars are don't really go whole hog into this, because like, I want to see the days, I want to see the events, I want to see, like, I don't need everything to be shaded or floating or have borders around it or be inset on a rounded rectangle or have fancy backgrounds or anything like that. I don't think this app, functionally, I think people would find it harder to both use this app to set up a thing and make invitations, and also more difficult to accept or reject an invitation or look at it to figure out when the invitation is, like, just the basic functionality of it. Like, I think this app works way better in screenshots and WWDC demos than it does in real life for its intended purpose. And it's not bad. There's nothing like bad or wrong with it. I just feel like sometimes it's, I don't know, too much missing the forest for the trees. Like, I want the info.
It's too cute by half.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even that cute. It's not like they're shredding papers like the wallet thing or whatever. It's just, I'm not sure they've, it's just, it's kind of like visually like really busy wallpaper, like on a house, right? It's just too much, right? I just need to know the event, who's coming, who's not, how do I reply, how do I set, like, and I felt like the app was kind of visually and interface-wise fighting me. I found it spot on a lot of times searching for stuff that was just like beautifully inset and like text on a colored background or whatever. It's too much for me.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is very pretty to look at. I think it's a very good showy example of what an iOS app can be. But the thing of it is that I feel like a lot of the conventions and maybe affordances, but the way it works is so dissimilar from standard iOS apps that I feel it's almost off-putting. Maybe that's because I'm getting older. I don't know. But I feel like a really good iOS app to my eyes, is one that has the same conventions as most other apps on the platform, but does it in a very unique style. And I think, Marco, you know, your work over your entire iOS career has been a really good example of this, where I think, generally speaking, you take the kind of gist of what an iOS app is, put something or several somethings on top. A simple example of this may be a custom font, and I actually don't think that's particularly necessary these days, and you've said the same in mm-hmm. years past. But as a silly example, you know, take a standard table view, but put a custom font on it, or, you know, something along those lines. So you can still look and you don't have to squint to say, oh yeah, this is a table, just like I'm used to. It you immediately say, oh, this is a table, but it's a pretty table. And I feel like this app, while unquestionably very pretty, it's cumbersome on account of it breaking the conventions that you're used to. The other thing I didn't love about it is, so I set up a Super Bowl party for myself, and I copied a link, which that's I liked, that you didn't have to. It's going to be a real exciting party, y'all. I copied the link to it, which I did approve, or, you know, I approve of the fact that you don't need to send it to an email or phone number or what have you. And then I opened up a Chrome incognito window to go to that link and see what happens. And it was very off-putting, not because it required me to create an account or anything like that, which would have been a non-starter immediately, but it wanted to do the, like, let's verify this email dance. And, you know, so let's verify the email by sending you a 6-digit code, then you got to type it in. And I had set my invite to require permission to say, you know, you're attending or what have you, or I guess it was maybe even to answer the question, you know, at all. And so once I went through with this anonymous user and said, okay, I would like to be a part of this, please, then the me that's the invite owner, you know, I put that hat on again. So back on my iPhone, I guess you could say, I then need to approve the fact that this person even wants to see what's happening, which I get why they do that, because, you know, my home address was on this invite, you know, as an example, but it's a little bit cumbersome. And then once the anonymous user back in Chrome goes to accept, you know, the invitation or decline or say maybe or what have you, it's got to do that whole login dance again, or not login, but like, okay, I'd like to do this now. Okay, what's the 6-digit code? Okay, it's 123456. You know, and it's just a little bit off-putting. And I approve generally of the fact that they're trying to do this in such a way that you know, you don't have to full-on create an account, but it's kind of a lot of work. And if you are not in the Apple ecosystem, it's certainly workable. I'm not saying it's impossible. And to be honest with you, in my experience with Evite, oh my word, this is so much nicer. So much nicer. But I saw somewhere, and unfortunately I didn't think to write it down, but I saw somewhere that somebody had offered an alternative app that does this. I think it started with a P, but the name is escaping me.
The app that's complaining that Apple essentially copied
them. Yes.
They cited the part of like the App Store guidelines that said, don't upload copycat apps. Don't just take someone else's app and modify the interface a little.
Yeah.
So they're real bitter that their app, this apparently looks and works a lot like their app. But I think Evite is a good example because, I mean, maybe there's no avoiding this, but like, if you are not Apple, if you do not own a platform and you are trying to make an app for people to make invitations to events, you're going to make sure that it is platform agnostic, because you don't want anyone not to use your app because someone in their family doesn't use the same platform or some friend doesn't use the same platform. You're like, look, doesn't matter what you use. If you want to invite people to a thing, use Evite. We don't care what computer you're on, what device you're on, what OS you're on. We need to make it good and the same everywhere for everybody. Apple does not work that way because they are a platform owner, and I think it hurts the app. Like that. So this is from, you should read this next thing from The Verge about Apple's ecosystem integration.
Sure. So from The Verge, the experience has some hiccups for those not fully in the Apple ecosystem, which isn't surprising. For starters, where an iPhone user can go straight to the invitation using your link, assuming they're already signed into iCloud, Android users have to enter their email address and then get a verification code to get in. This is what I was talking about a minute ago. They'll also need to sign up for an Apple account to look at a photo album if you had one. And Android user or not, your friends need an Apple Music subscription to hear your playlist. Otherwise, they'll only get a preview of it. mean, that I do kind of get, but it's all, I get both sides of that. Like, it's kind of crummy, but what is Apple really supposed to do there? Anyway, coming back to The Verge, none of that will keep Android users from seeing key details about your event or RSVPing to it, but it'll be obvious that they aren't getting the whole experience.
It's kind of like with Apple and like Apple TV Plus or whatever. They just have to get over the idea that, like, imagine if Apple TV Plus was only available if you had an Apple TV hardware puck. Like, that would be ridiculous, right? And I feel like they're in the same spot. It's like, well, what else can we do? Of course the playlist is going to be in Apple Music. And if you want to see the photo album, everyone knows there's no way to share photos without having an iCloud account. So, of course, we have to make them have an iCloud account. Like, if you were Evite or something, you'd be like, share a Spotify playlist, share a Tidal playlist, share a YouTube Music. You'd support them all because you don't want any reasons for someone to not use your thing. You want to make, like, the best experience for everybody involved, right? And Apple is kind of trying to do that, but it's so heavily weighted. Jason, at one point, Jason Snell thought that you had to have an iCloud account to do it, simply because if you try to use an email account on an Apple device that it knows you that it belongs to an iCloud account, it forces you to sign into iCloud. So he thought it was just impossible not to do it. Like, they're just so heavily herding you towards things. And it's like, in the end, sending an invitation to an event and accepting an invitation does not require any kind of Apple thing. You can do it without it. Companies do it without it. But of course, Apple integrates with it and makes that the happy path. And I feel like it's going to have to make people feel like left out. And then I feel like this whole experience doesn't pass the very difficult, I was going to call it a sniff test, but more like the very difficult trial that is using any technology product with people who are not technology enthusiasts. Like, say you're planning, like, your parents' 50th wedding anniversary, and you being a tech nerd is like, I know, I'll set up an Apple invitation for it. And everyone's like, what is this? What do I have to do? Is this a thing? Like what benefit? Like, maybe they would humor you, but they're like, is this helping at all? Or is this just, like, now another thing we have to deal with? And, oh, Aunt Sue has an Android phone. How is she going to do? Like, and in the end, they'd be like, what benefit are we getting? Why don't we just use Evite? Everyone knows how to use Evite. Yep. We used that for Timmy's birthday party last month. Like, just this sort of the disappointment and sigh you get from trying to foist any kind of sort of, like, new, shiny proprietary Apple, but look, and you say, but look how beautiful this invitation looks on my phone. See how the background is color themed to the transparent buttons with a bright out, and they're like, I don't care. Just, people need to know in, like, very high contrast, bold, simple text that's easy to find where and when the event is, who's going, and whether they've already RSVP'd it. Like, and that's where stuff like this falls down. Like, I don't fault the people making the app. I think it's a beautiful app. I think it makes for great demos, but, like, this approach to making apps is a poor fit for what this app does. Maybe it's a good fit for food trucks or backyard birds, but it's a poor fit for inviting people to an event, because that activity has nothing to do with Apple platforms. Nothing.
Yeah. Partyful, by the way, real-time follow-up. Partyful, which we'll put a link in the show notes, is the app that I was thinking of, which was mentioned actually in this Verge article. Yeah, I mean, I respect the idea. I think it's a good idea. I think that certainly by Apple standards, they have far more affordances for other platforms than they typically would. I feel like Apple forgets that Android exists a lot of the time.
They don't forget. They just don't care.
Well, okay, fair. But yeah, I mean, it is visually very impressive from a usability standpoint. I didn't love it. It wasn't actively bad, but it was just a little bit too different for my taste. If you haven't actually participated in it, seen it, what have you, a friend of the show, Stephen Robles, has a good video on it that we'll put a link in the show notes for that. It's good. It's worth trying. And certainly if I had a situation where I knew everyone involved was in the Apple ecosystem, this is where I would probably turn. But I think perhaps for me, the best thing to come from this is I learned about Partyful, which is a alternative to Evite, which I freaking hate. And thankfully I almost never have to do that. But still, I don't like Evite at all.
And to contrast this, like, when can the, like, all the same kind of philosophy, when can that, when is that a good fit? An example would be something like, well, maybe this is not a great example. It's an example that for my life is a good example. Flight tracking. Flighty on the iPhone is amazing.
Yeah.
And its amazingness can be isolated to the iPhone and still benefit you. Because, yes, there's like, oh, what if I want to share the flight with other people, blah, blah. But in the use case where, like, because parties are always sharing with everybody, unless you're having a party by yourself like Casey, right? Events always involve multiple people. But flight tracking sometimes, in fact, I would say frequently, just involves one person. right? Or maybe two people, but not like a huge number of people. And so the goodness of Flighty being confined to the iPhone, I'm assuming it doesn't exist in other platforms, being totally confined to the iPhone does not hurt that application when you're using it solo to deal with your flights or a flight of one of your loved ones and you're picking them up at the airport. You know what I mean? Like, then you can go whole hog, do whatever you want, require whatever proprietary platform stuff or whatever, because it's just me and my iPhone. And there, I'm not foisting this on other people. If I was taking a family vacation and it was people, an extended 25 of us were going to Europe or something, I would not say, everyone buy an iPhone and get Flighty because we're all going to share our flights together. And it's like, that's too much. Like, for technology stuff, if you're trying to make other people do something so they can use a technology thing that you like because you think somehow this is going to benefit everybody, I can tell you most people do not agree that is going to benefit them. And to the extent they humor you, you should be thankful. But in general, it's not a benefit. So, yeah, I think this is just the wrong approach. So it's a good thing this app will wither and die at some point.
Brutal. I mean, you're not wrong, but brutal. Speaking of brutal, did you try it on the iPad yet?
Yeah, I just saw I use it with Instagram. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. 0 for 3 on new apps on iPad. No iPad app for sports, journal, or invites as we record this in February of 2025.
Yeah, I'm so annoyed. Continue to be annoyed that Instagram has no iPad app. Maybe I should just stop using Instagram, but that hasn't happened yet. But anyway, it's been how many years? But then you look at Apple. And Apple not putting its own small apps. Like, they push so hard. It's like, make your app with this. Use Swift UI. You can deploy it on every platform and use the same code base for Mac, for iOS, for iPadOS, for Apple TV. It's great. And then they come out with 3 apps in a row, Sports, Journal, and Invites, that are like small apps. And it's like, no, of course, forget about an Apple TV version of it. Forget about a Mac version of it. There's not even an iPad version of it. Not a good advertisement for the amazing cross-platform ability of their UI frameworks when they're just like, yeah, no, these are just on the iPhone. That's it.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not great, Bob.
If Apple can't be bothered to make its own apps be on the iPad, what kind of leg do they have to stand on to say, well, you're not the second or third biggest company in the world, but you independent developers working by yourself, make sure you have a version of this for all of our platforms.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the also Vision Pro. I mean, most, a large subset of Vision Pro apps that are pre-installed, you know, that come with the OS are just iPad apps rather than Vision Pro apps. You know, it's the same problem. It's I don't know.
At least Vision Pro, like, you know, if you make an iPhone app, making a good Vision Pro version of that is much harder than making a good iPad version of that app. Like,
yeah.
just I mean, even if you don't make a good iPad version, just make a version that doesn't require you to run the phone version and then zoom it to 2x. It was like just minimal bait. Like, again, maybe it is 2 interns doing this. I don't know. Again, the app is well implemented. It is a nice app. It is a good app. They should release the source code as a WWDC demo.
I was just thinking that. You stole it from me.
It's probably way more complicated than we think it is, because all real apps.
Even better.
All real apps are way more complicated and do weird stuff, and they're not going to release it. But
won't, but I think it would be an interesting case study.
Well, we got the Mac Paint source code now. So, you know, fast forward that number of years and we'll have the Sports Journal Invites source code on archive.org.
Anything you feel like is missing from it, John?
Yeah. So even just within the world of Apple stuff. So forget about this. It's you and your Apple using family. No worry about cross-platform stuff. You love the interface. You don't care that it's hard to find stuff or that it looks weird or whatever. You just love it. It's great. Even then, this app doesn't do everything that it should, because one of the most frequently requested things that people want when there's some event is a place to talk about that event in real time-ish, a Slack channel or like a message group or whatever. And guess what? Apple has a messaging platform. It's called Messages. There could be a group message thread that would auto-add everybody who accepts the invitation, and you could discuss, hey, who's bringing potato chips, who's bringing this, but nope. The app doesn't do that. Now, granted, it's just 1.0, whatever. I understand, but it's just, like, you have to go one direction or the other. Either this is an app for Apple users who use all Apple stuff and love Apple things and everyone's all Apple integrated, or it's cross-platform. And this is, like, half Apple integrated, but doesn't even integrate with all the Apple stuff and doesn't even have a way to do one of the most frequently requested things. Like, I think more people want to discuss who's bringing potato chips in a message thread than want to make a playlist for your party.
Yep. Very true. All right. Hey, parents, if you are listening with young ones nearby, we're going to talk about that news that's been going around the Apple world recently. So maybe pause the program.
I mean, it's
not.
We're going to be talking about an app that shows people in it that just happen to not be wearing anything. I don't think we need to get more hardcore than that.
Well, no, I agree. But, you know, in case you have sensitive and young, very young ears nearby, just be aware. So what am I talking about? Yes. So according to AltStore, Apple has approved their first porn app for the iPhone. And so reading from The Verge, the first, quote, Apple-approved, quote, porn app for iPhone is rolling out in Europe via AltStore's PAL alternative to the iOS app marketplace. AltStore PAL developer Riley Testet says that Hot Tub, which describes itself as an ad-free adult content browser, has made it through Apple's notarization review for fraud, security threats, and functionality, and will be available for AltStore PAL users in the EU to download starting a couple of days ago. So, AltStore had a post on Threads, which we will link in the show notes. And there's an image on there that says, introducing Hot Tub, the first Apple-approved porn app. Download now on AltStore PAL. Apple was not happy about this at all. So Apple issued a statement to several different outlets. We are deeply concerned about the safety risks that hardcore porn apps of this type create for EU users, especially kids. This app and others like it will undermine consumer trust and confidence in our ecosystem that we have worked for more than a decade to make the best in the world. Contrary to the false statements made by the marketplace developer, we certainly do not approve of this app and would never offer it in our app store. The truth is that we are required by the European Commission to allow it to be distributed by marketplace operators like AltStore and Epic, who may not share our concerns for user safety. Sick burn. Riley Testet, again, reacted with a toot of his own. It reads as follows. My response to Apple's statement on Hot Tub. There are two screenshots, the first of which is a post from 9to5Mac. Riley has highlighted the following passage. Contrary to the false statements made by the marketplace developer, we certainly do not approve of this app. The second screenshot is App Store Connect saying, and I am quoting, the following app has been approved for distribution. App name, Hot Tub Video Player. Riley or AltStore broadly then had a later on response. That response reads, Apple is claiming we made false statements about the approval of Hot Tub. This is not true. All apps distributed with AltStore PAL must be submitted to Apple for notarization. Unlike macOS, iOS notarization involves a human review process where Apple employees manually review apps that they before they are either, quote, approved or, quote, rejected for distribution, in Apple's own words. Unfortunately, Apple has rejected several apps from our store in the past for dubious reasons. So the phrase Apple approved in our marketing is a reference to the fact that Hot Tub was approved, not rejected, by Apple for notarization. To be perfectly clear, Apple has not endorsed Hot Tub in any way. However, they did approve it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the stupid situation that Apple has gotten themselves in.
Let me just repeat what you just said, because it's important that Apple has gotten themselves in.
Right, because they are the ones who made notarization editorial for the EU.
A weapon, yeah.
And so here's the thing. And what they did, so what, again, we've gone over this before, so I'll be quick. What the notarization process has been for years before this was a process on the Mac that software was run through only automated checks, and it was mainly to look for, like, known malware signatures. And then the main thing about notarization is that if an app was found to contain malware, to be malware, that was notarized, Apple could then revoke that signature server-side, and then all Macs would eventually, I guess, get that revocation and not allow that binary to run. So that was an automated process that did not involve Apple having human reviewers look at each app. They used the same word to describe a very different process with the alternative app stores in the EU. They use that same word to ostensibly do the same thing of, like, we're just going to give it a cursory check to make sure it isn't literal malware for security reasons. But then they started rejecting apps that were not malware, like the VMAC emulator, which they rejected on trademark grounds. Now, I actually understand why they did that, because trademarks need to be defended. And if you don't defend your trademark, and if there's evidence that you're not defending your trademark, somebody could try to get it invalidated. So,
well,
they created
defend,
the situation.
When they say defending your trademark, they mean, like, suing people, which they still could have done while still allowing it through. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yes, of course. But they could, you know, but if they decided that this is going to be a human review process on iOS, Because here's the thing. Apple hates that they have to allow the EU ad. Like, they hate it so much. And Apple is not a good loser. Like, they're not. They're a very sore loser when they lose an argument about something. They hate it. They cannot deal. And so they decided to, you know, be Apple about it and have, you know, no flexibility and try to be as weaselly and prickly as possible to try to make the alternative app stores fail as much as possible. And so they put themselves in it. They injected themselves into this process that is ostensibly only for automated security checks everywhere else, but they made it a human review. So now anything that that actually gets, quote, approved through notarization on the EU alternative app stores, yes, a human at Apple definitely did look at that and definitely did decide this is okay. And then it is approved. That is very different from passing a scan or being digitally signed. Those are very different things. That's what notarization was. This is approval. Now, it's probably, you know, fewer of the rules are being enforced compared to their, you know, the Apple official app store. But it's still a human approval. It didn't need to be. Apple injected themselves into that role because they couldn't deal. So they put themselves there, and now they have to bear the consequences of that. And those consequences include if they let something through that infringes your trademarks, they could be held liable for that in a bad way. Or in the case of approving a porn app, yeah, Apple did approve a porn app. They could have set up the system differently. They still can. It's not too late to change it. But they could have set the system up differently in a way that was more straightforward, but they refused to. They created this problem 100% themselves, and they deserve all of the press that it generates.
Yeah, they don't have to defend their trademark in this thing. As they say in their statement here, the truth is we are required by a European Commission to allow it to be distributed by marketplace operators like Altstar, right? So there's, like, first of all, it's rich for Apple saying suddenly now they care about what the European Commission allows that it requires them to do by law. They right. just ignore it when
and,
they feel
and if
like
that's,
it, right?
Yeah, if that's required by law, then what happened to VMAC? Hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Like when it's something they want to do, oh, we just have to follow the law. But if something they don't want to do, it's like law schmaw. But anyway, court-wise, they could absolutely allow things that infringe their copyright through and then deal with it the way you deal with all copyright, which is you sue the people out of existence, you send them a cease and desist, yes. you bring them to court. Like, that's defending your trademark. You don't need to, even if you have introduced yourself as a human element, allowing that thing to go through, you can say, well, but we have to do this because the European Commission, as we read many shows ago, says here's what you can stop apps for. And intellectual property is not one of the things. So they're saying, look, this is the law in the EU. We are following the EU law. No court is going to say, well, now you didn't defend your trademark, so you don't own Mac anymore. Like, they're fine. That is not an excuse for them doing this. They could have 100% human review of every single thing that goes to the EU App Store, let sail through a bunch of stuff that infringes their own copyright, and no court is going to say, oh, you didn't defend your copyright, because the law is clear on this. But anyway, yeah, they're just trying to have it both ways. And this argument is so ridiculous, because anybody who is a speaker of the English language understands the difference between we approve of this as in philosophically we think this is the right thing to do versus we have approved this, which means there is a process and we can reject or approve. Those are two different things. Apple knows they're two different things. Altstar knows they're two different things. They're just talking past each other, and it's very silly. And, you know, maybe, you know, I think the Altstar people might get sued because of, like, the laws where you can't make it in an advertisement, you can't make it look like some company endorses something when they don't. Because despite the silly difference, saying the first Apple-approved porn app, that is probably going to not win in court if Apple decides to fight them on that. Because in those two definitions of approved, a casual person looking at this ad would absolutely think that they're using the other definition, which is Apple philosophically thinks this is appropriate. They would not say, oh, it's so clear that this is part of a process that Apple had to do for the EU. Like, so this ad by Altstar is probably extremely ill-advised. Doing anything to anger Apple around this is ill-advised because Apple has a lot of money and they're mean. As Jason wrote in a good story that we'll link in the show notes, Altstar pokes the bear. Doing anything to antagonize Apple seems like not a great idea unless you're trying to pull an epic and go like, we're going to antagonize them because we know they will crush us. And then when they crush us, we'll be like, see, look, Apple's crushing us. I don't know. They're picking a silly fight here. But if they want to be the standard bearer for Apple's hypocrisy when it comes to the following EU laws and dealing with the Altstar, you know, more power to them. But and this is not even getting to the whole thing of like, Apple's statement makes it seem like any kind of like sex-based thing we would never allow that on the App Store. In fact, Apple humans don't have sex. We don't even know about sex, right? versus the actual harms involved in pornography. And it is a complicated issue, but like it's kind of as a given in all these things, sort of the Disneyfication of like, of course, Apple would never do or say such a thing, and no one at Apple has ever had sex or seen anyone else have sex or anything like that. And it's very kind of like prudish and silly. On the flip side, though, do you want your store to be filled with hardcore porn apps, and every time you open up the App Store app on your phone, it's just, you know, hardcore pornography blinking in your face? No, you don't want that either, right? So there actually is some nuance to this issue that neither side of this is really willing to tackle. They're not even willing to deal with the thing they both understand, which is the two different contexts for the word approve in here. But anyway, I don't see this ending well for anybody. It's already not ending well for Apple because they're just making themselves look stupid and even more hypocritical. And I'm not sure it's going to end well for Alt Store either. I know they have Epic backing them, with the big money bags, Epic helping them not have to pay the core technology fee or whatever, but this is another mess. It's entertaining to see people poking at each other like this, but like Jason says, don't poke the bear. Like, I wish I could come up with an animal analogy that was more appropriate. Maybe if you were a cheese mite. I don't know. People don't know what cheese mites are. Maybe you're one of those mites that lives in your eyelashes. No, people don't want to think about that. There are mites
living
in
your eyelashes.
These are terrible
examples. This is getting worse. Stop, please.
Like a microscopic thing, like a tiny thing that's so small you can't see it with the naked eye versus the sun. That is Alt Store versus Apple. In terms of how much money they both have to wage punitive lawsuits. Oh my
God. Yeah, it's not a stellar look for anyone involved, but I really think that this would have been so much more cut and dry if, as Marco had started, or had said when we first started talking about it, if Apple didn't use notarization for, editorializing and just wielding it as a weapon. When we saw that notarization was going to be involved with the DMA or not the DMA, whatever this stuff is called. When we saw that they were going to use notarization, all of us thought, okay, yeah, that should be fine. It may not be fine, but it should be fine. It's been fine on the Mac. It shouldn't be a big deal. They're just going to make sure it's not actively hurting your device. And then it should go straight. Everything should go straight on through. Right. 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 And it quickly became obvious that no, since Apple didn't have any other weapons to use, they use notarization. And I didn't like it then. I don't like it now. And honestly, they are reaping what they sowed. And I don't have a lot of sympathy for Apple on this one. They've made this bed. Now they get to sleep in it.
They deserve no sympathy because there were so many easily avoidable problems here, and they chose not to avoid them. So this is the kind of thing, this is the kind of messiness that their approach is going to keep creating.
I'm not sure Apple even sees this as messiness, because this is an opportunity for them to, as Gruber was pointing out, to gloat, to say, see, this is what we told you would happen. See, if you let other people sell things, someone's going to sell a porn app. I told you it would happen. Look, it's happening, a porn app.
And oh my God.
Getting into all the things of how many different ways you can get porn on your phone through web apps or through the Reddit app or whatever. And it's just, the world is a complicated place. But the hypocrisy is clear to anyone looking. But I feel like Apple feels like this is a PR win for them, because they're like, surely everyone hates porn just like we do. And now we're saying, see, now you see the violence inherent in the system, right? Like, these people, we let the European Union let them do things, and now they're putting out porn apps, and now the world's going to end, because prior to this, no one could get porn, but now they'll be able to.
That's correct.
I want to read from Jason's article, because I thought this was a good little bit. Apple claims that their hands are tied by the European Commission, and yet the company has used its lever before to protect users from, checking my notes here, emulators are very old Macs models. Seems dangerous. So which is it? Is notarization a tool that Apple can use to bypass all of European regulations of whatever Apple feels like it's preventing users from running Mac Paint on an iPad? Or is it something out of Apple's hands? If Apple chose to exercise notarization powers to kill the UTM and mini vMac emulators, but then let Hot Tub through, doesn't Alt Store have a point? It's hard for Apple to argue its hands are tied if it's used those hands in the recent past. And then he says parenthetically, I've contacted Apple's PR representatives and asked if they can explain the disparity in policies to me, and I'll update the stories if they reply. Last time I checked, they hadn't replied, but not sure what their response is. But yeah, he gets right to the heart of it. Like, I think Apple thinks that this is like a triumph for them, and really just anyone who cares about this issue at all looks at it and says, this is not a good look for you, Apple.
Hello, Feature Marco. It is 1 hour, 15 minutes or thereabouts, which we're doing pretty good. Do you want to do Sonos now, which I'm sort of leaning toward?
Well, or we could do Ask ADP and then do Sonos as overtime.
I'm fine with that.
We could.
I have no problem with that. It is a little consistent.
We did Sonos last time for overtime, so it kind of follows it. All right. Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Well, I'll go until I think we need to be done, or if one of you thinks we need to be done, then just cut
me
off.
Let me look at the Ask ADP.
I think let's do like, you know, 2 or 3.
2 to 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. Let's do some Ask ATP. Matthew Fenslau writes, I recently got an ATP membership. Thank you. HP.fm/join, and have been going back through past episodes to listen to the bonus content. One recurring theme is that Marco and Casey's number one wish for Mac is cellular. I'm really surprised by this. I travel for work both domestically and internationally frequently and work outside my office several days a week. These days, I rarely find it hard to access decent Wi-Fi, and on the rare occasion I do, I just fall back to phone tethering, which works much better than a few years ago. Most of my fellow road warriors do the same. My understanding is that cellular Windows laptops are not super popular. I would love to know what are the use cases that make the guys so desirous of cellular Macs, especially since they don't seem to be big travelers. Is there something specific for being a software developer? This is one of those things that John rightfully brings up. Oh, we need to answer this question every year. And I say that I probably sound like I'm complaining. I'm not trying to. It seems that we're getting enough new listeners that people either forget, like me, or have never heard the answer before. And so let's cover it again. For me, I want to have a Mac that I know can, you know, asterisk, dagger, double dagger, can always get on the internet. It doesn't need anything else. Don't need to wait for tethering. Don't need to worry about tethering. Don't need to destroy the battery of two devices simultaneously, only the one. It can always get online. Again, if you're in a plane or whatever, it doesn't, you know what I'm saying. And a great example of this is I would love to be able to use my Mac in the car easily and whenever I want. And I can do that. Yes, I certainly could do that. And I could tether. But it's so nice with my cellular iPad. If I have it in the car, and I'm talking about as a passenger in case I wasn't clear. If I'm a passenger in the car, you know what I do to get on the internet on my iPad? I open my iPad. That's what I do because it's already on the internet because it has a cellular connection. Yes, 100%. There are ways around this. And To be fair, they've gotten far less egregious over the years. You know, you can have your Mac connect to your phone and it will magically just start personal hotspot on your phone, usually, often, but not always. And yes, Wi-Fi does exist in a lot of places, but I don't particularly trust most Wi-Fi that isn't my own. And that's why I have some sort of VPN, in my case, past sponsor Tailscale. But even still, oftentimes Wi-Fi is not stellar. In fact, I go to places where the Wi-Fi is actually not as robust as my Verizon cellular connection. And that's kind of an indictment of the places that I sometimes go, but it is what it is. And so for me, I want to be able to open my laptop and immediately be on the internet. And if I can't be on the internet immediately, then it's an annoyance. And it's not so much of an annoyance that, you know, I can't get my work done or whatever. But if I had my druthers, I would 1,000% spend the extra $130 or in all likelihood, because it's a Mac, $260 in order to get a cellular modem in it. I don't know. Marco, tell me where I'm wrong or what did I leave out?
Zero parts of what you just said are wrong. So here's some other considerations that I have. So what I think what matters a lot is like when you open your laptop, first of all, if you're almost always using it in places that have known Wi-Fi networks, you've got no problem. If you're taking your laptop from home and you put it in a bag and you go to work and you open it up and you're in both cases, you're on the Wi-Fi, then I understand why you don't think cellular is that necessary. And for most people, that is their use pattern. So I get it. You go to your coffee shop, you open it up, you're on their Wi-Fi already because you've been there before. Fine. For most people, that is a totally fine use case. And so they wouldn't want to spend, you know, $50-$60 a month on a data plan for their laptop or whatever it would be, because that's, you know, they don't need it that often. But some people need it a lot. I take the train a lot. Trains don't usually have Wi-Fi. At least New York trains don't.
If they do, at least here in the States, they are so overloaded because it's, you know, hundreds of people on like a single cellular modem, and it's just garbage.
Yeah. Also, your beloved park bench that you like to work at.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably no Wi-Fi there, right? Because it's outdoors.
Nope. Correct.
And so there are places where if you frequently want to use a laptop in a place that is away from good Wi-Fi coverage or any Wi-Fi coverage, then this need comes up a lot more. I think one of the reasons it came up a lot for like business laptops in the early aughts and mid aughts, like that's you'd see it like as an option on ThinkPads and stuff, is because business people who use laptops are often business travelers, and business travelers might be going to all different, you know, they might be going to a new hotel every week or a new city or a new airport or whatever, and sometimes you don't want to, like, every one of those Wi-Fi networks that you join by going through their dumb captive portal where you got to like type in your room number and your last name, you are exfiltrating personal data every time you do that. You are granting yet another company access to whatever, you know, whatever data they can figure out about you by you know, your internet traffic and everything else. And yeah, VPNs can help with some of that, but it's an annoyance. It's a privacy exfiltration. And then the biggest thing to me is when I open my laptop, everything's out of date. All the data is out of date. And
oh, good point.
Mm-hmm. And when you're opening a laptop and you're connecting to Wi-Fi, both Wi-Fi itself is very fast, typically, or can be, and also the laptop instantly connects to the Wi-Fi. Like, you don't even, when you open up your laptop after going from your home to your work or your coffee shop, you don't even notice it connecting most of the time. It's just on. It's so fast to reconnect to Wi-Fi, and everything loads so quickly that when things like pop in here and there, you barely even have a chance to notice it. That is not the experience using tethering for cellular. Using tethering for cellular, you have to open the laptop up. The laptop has to realize that it can't find any Wi-Fi networks. Then, if you're lucky, it will prompt you with a notification thing in the corner saying, do you want to connect to Marco's iPhone? And there is, as far as I can tell, no way to make it automatically always connect to your tethering on your phone when you can't find Wi-Fi. As far as I can tell, there is no setting. I looked, when we last talked about this a couple weeks ago, I dug through the support articles. There's a setting that kind of sounds like it does this, but it doesn't. I don't know what is going on, but as far as I can tell, there is no such setting to say, always connect to my phone for tethering when you don't see a known Wi-Fi network. So the result is, when you're in these situations and you have a laptop and you open it up, the result is you're just looking at out-of-date data, and you'll be looking at it for probably at least 20 to 30 seconds, at least. And if that's when you have good coverage and good speeds and everything. So it's just, it's this huge paper cut. Every time you open your laptop on a train or whatever, you want to get work done, and you just have to wait and wait and wait. Do you want a user connection? Yes. Tap join. Wait. Mm-hmm. Wait. Maybe it'll join. Maybe it'll work. Sometimes it'll say refuse connection, sorry, and then you got to try it again. And then once it does connect, you got to wait. And you got to wait. And then stuff might then start coming in. And that whole time you're looking at outdated data. And maybe you like accidentally, you know, hit a keystroke in a note or move an email, and then you create a merge conflict when it does finally load. Like, there's so many paper cuts about that experience. So if you are somebody who that doesn't happen to very often because you're almost always using your laptop on known Wi-Fi networks, then fine, you don't need this. And that's why most people don't need this. But some of us do. And for the few of us that would use this frequently, the experience of having a connection built in, like you have on your phone, and every iPad ever, the experience of having that option versus having to tether to your phone is night and day. Tethering to your phone feels like dial-up. It feels like, okay, I've opened the computer up, but it's not on the internet, of course. I have to tell the computer, go to the internet, connect to the internet, log on. You have to say, mm-hmm. And then you wait, and you wait. And then maybe if you're lucky, welcome. You've got mail. Like, it takes a while. And it's such a back in time experience. And with all of our amazing technology that we have these days, it feels ridiculous to have that experience with like the latest Apple laptops, the latest iPhones. We have tethering. It's a service that we pay for. Like, we're allowed to do it. We're not doing a trick. This is a built in feature. It just is really half-assed, and the experience of using it is not amazing. What would be much more amazing... Oh, and you're also draining your phone battery doing this, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, usually when I'm on the train doing this, if I'm taking the train to the city, usually I will have to then plug my phone in to a battery pack or the laptop with a cable just to keep the phone topped up so I don't arrive at the city with a phone at 60%. So, like, it's everything about it is a compromise. And that compromise is fine for people who hardly ever need it, it's just an occasional need. But when it's a regular need, it sucks. And there are so many better ways to do this. So what would be great, which I hope we get this someday, you know, pray to, you know, the spirit of Mark Gurman or whatever. Hopefully we can have built-in cell modems in laptops. How would this work? The same way it works on your iPhone and your iPad. It would just always be connected. And every so often in the background, it could wake itself up while keeping the screen off and download data. There have been features to do this in macOS for a very long time, just not over cellular. So that's what has to happen. There are downsides to this. The laptop would be more expensive. You'd have to buy a data plan. If you leave cellular on and you leave the laptop unplugged for a week, it will probably drain itself. That's all a trade-off that many of us would make. Because the utility of opening that laptop and having it just be on the same way your phone is just on. Like, your phone is online. When you open up your phone, when you pull out of your pocket and wake it up, it's online already. You don't have to tell it go online and update your data. It's already online, and a few minutes ago it did update its data. So it's already there. Such a different experience. Why can't the Mac do that? And there are no good reasons left. So please, hopefully, Apple, if you can forgive me for all my comments earlier about your stupid notarization thing, please, for the love of God, please give me a cellular laptop.
Yeah.
I don't even travel that much, but having used a cellular iPad while traveling, that's all it takes to convince you. Like, it sounds academic. It sounds like, oh, but whatever, I'm sure it's better, but does it really make a difference? If you just use a cellular iPad when you're on the go, once you get used to that, it's hard to go back to the other way, because it's just and it's the phone doesn't convince me. It was like, well, of course phones are always like that, but computer things, like, but a cellular iPad is such a great, like, well, it's not really a phone, it's big, and you're doing, maybe you have a keyboard connected to it or whatever, and you look at it and you're like, oh, I see why tethering sucks now, because I don't have to think about it at all with my iPad. It's just like my phone, it's always on. And, you know, once you experience that, or I mean, maybe it's worse on PC laptops. Some people say that, hey, if PC laptops are cellular, it's not good, but I can tell you, cellular on the iPad works as well as it does on the phone. And if you use a cellular iPad where you're actually using the cellular part of it, it is a pretty strong convincer that you would want this on a Mac.
Yeah, and by the way, like, the argument that it's not very good on PC laptops, nothing is very good on PC laptops. So that's not a valid argument.
No argument here. I mean, it's just, I would love it. I would absolutely love it. I would order one, you know, immediately if possible. I would, you know, if I had just bought a MacBook Pro, which I did, 2 years ago? I have an M3, so I think it was 2 years ago. It doesn't matter. Even if I've just bought one, I would immediately, you know, sell that to somebody or trade it in and buy another if I could suddenly get cellular on it. But
also, like, they already have a computer named MacBook Air. The Air prefix used to mean cellular in lots of different products, like, because you're using waves over the air for your connectivity. Like, it's a perfect name for a cellular laptop. Come on.
Yeah. That's all right. Stephen Swift writes, on episode 620, mentioned issues when users do iPhone mirroring on corporate computers, which made me wonder, how are people doing that? Are they signing in with their personal iCloud accounts and their corporate Macs? I've long wanted to take advantage of iPad sidecar or iPhone mirroring, but my Mac is a corporate machine. Is it safe to log in with my personal iCloud account on my work Mac if I don't want my employer to have access to my personal data? My employer doesn't want their IP on my personal devices. Do you know of any workarounds to use iPad sidecar, universal control, or iPhone mirror across iCloud accounts? I wish Apple would set up some authorization mechanism that didn't rely on devices signed into the same account. I do agree with Stephen there. Like, some sort of alternative auth would be nice, although I understand why Apple does it the way they do. For me, my last couple of jobby jobs, they were small firms that I trusted, which, yes, everyone's starting to fire up their email, you know, clients and tell me why I should never trust my employer. And that's true. In the most recent one, you know, the IT guy was a really good friend of mine, so I really, really trusted him. But if I was working at traditional corporate America, where I'm one cog in a machine that's 30,000 cogs big or whatever, I would definitely feel very differently about it. Another thing to consider is that, and I don't know how long this has been true, and it's definitely true on the iPhone, and I think it's true on the Mac. If your device is employer-owned, they can absolutely, without your permission, if they set it up to allow this, they can wipe that machine, and you have nothing you can do about it. You know, all your data is just gone. And I get why that is. Again, I don't really think that that's necessarily unreasonable. But again, that would give me pause to log into anything personal on it. So I don't know what I would say. And I'm curious, John, as the one with the most recent corporate experience and corporate experience with a much bigger corporation than I was used to, how did you handle this? Was I nuts to do this when I was in my little baby jobs?
Well, to answer your Matthew's question, are people signing in with their personal Apple IDs at work? Yes, they are. People do that all the time. Right. It's not a good idea. You shouldn't do it. But people do it because it's convenient. It's not a good idea for so many reasons. Casey just outlined some of them. There are many more reasons. It's probably even against your company's policy if you're at a big company. But people want their stuff, and they want access to their stuff. And so they do this, and it's not a good idea. They might do it to get access to Universal Control or Sidecar or whatever. And it is kind of annoying that Apple's handling of we keep saying Apple IDs. It's Apple account now. Apple's handling of Apple accounts.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Is so primitive. Like Apple accounts / Apple IDs are not new. They've been around for, I believe, decades at this point, multiple decades probably. And yet the ability to deal with them in any reasonable fashion is just so limited. Can you merge two Apple accounts? Can you transfer things from one Apple account to another? Can you be signed into multiple Apple accounts at a time? And you would be saying, well, these are complications. They should never do that. It's too complicated. No, you don't do that the first year or the fifth year or the 10th year. But the 25th year, maybe you should have the ability to merge Apple IDs, right? Or maybe you should have the ability to authenticate with some of your services without an Apple ID. Like, in some respects, they do. Like, I believe they still support VPN with password instead of, like, screen sharing through Apple ID stuff. But they love the simplifying assumption of everything's on the same Apple ID. It drives me bananas here just within this room, within this physical room. I've complained about this before, trying to airdrop things. I walk over to my wife's computer and I want to airdrop something. It's like, oh, I can't airdrop it from my phone because she's on her account and her computer and I'm on my account and my thing. And I try to airdrop it and for some reason it doesn't see her or whatever. And it's just like, I got to be logged into this, my account to get the thing. It's just, that's why apps like, I saw this go by recently. I forget who originally suggested this. Somebody, a Gruber, posted it about it. Like, essentially an app that does what AirDrop does.
Yeah, it was Underscore that brought it up, then Gruber picked it up.
There you go. But it's not Apple. It is a thing that says, we don't care what your Apple ID is. We have our own system for doing it. AirDrop is like, oh, isn't AirDrop great? It's like, yeah, sure. If you live in a world where every one of your devices is signed into your Apple ID, it's great. But I don't live in that world, and so it sucks. And I know you're supposed to, it shouldn't be, you don't have to be in the same Apple ID to AirDrop, but you should just, they're in your contacts, and it should work. Oh, should. Yeah, it should work, but it doesn't. I don't know why it doesn't. It just doesn't, and it drives me insane. So this is another example of that. I want to use this cool feature, you know, Universal Control or Sidecar, these features that you think of these as like, the Mac has this feature, the iPad has this feature. It's like, no, this is all threaded through Apple IDs. And if you're not on the same Apple ID and all these devices, it's like, nope, sorry, you don't get to use this. And I understand it's a simplifying assumption for their implementation, but I feel like Apple should set the bar a little bit higher for itself and say, in version 2, in version 3, in version 17, maybe think about the complication of, you know, people having different accounts. Even so simple as like a feedback that I filed, I think, a couple of years ago. Like my complication of my difficulty trying to do simple file sharing in the Finder between two computers that are, you know, 7 feet from each other. But oh no, I want to sign into my wife's computer where I do have an account, but I want to sign in with her account. And I want to have like an alias that will correctly pull the password for her account that's in my keychain from the, nope, 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 nope. You're going to type in that password every time. It will not remember it. There's a checkbox that says put this into the keychain, but that checkbox does nothing because every time you want to open that alias or double click that thing or mount that thing or whatever, it's going to reprompt you. And I filed the bug on it. They're like, oh, you should just leave the username out of the SMB URL you're connecting to, and then it will pull from the keychain. It's like, yeah, it'll pull my password on my account from the keychain, but I want to log into her account. Like, they can't get it through their the idea of, like, how, why in the world would you log into someone else's account on their Mac when you mount that share? It's like, because I want
to go to
put,
a good video store.
I want to put my 1099s into her tax folder. That's what I want to do, right? It's in her account. It's in her documents folder. Oh, my God. Like, these are complications. These are things you don't do when you first roll stuff out, but you should eventually get to them, and Apple just never gets to them. And so for this situation, I don't specifically know. I think what's the sidecar one? There is some app that like Sidecar was inspired by that I can no longer remember the name of that you might be able to try that I think is not tied to Apple ID.
Oh, yeah, they sold little dongles. What, I forget the name.
Oh, God. Less
chat room will tell us what it is.
Luma Fusion, something like that.
Yeah, maybe that is right. And Universal Control, there before Universal Control, there were a bunch of things from like the Linux world that also worked on Mac that did something similar, let you like move your pointer from one machine to the other. None of those things, with the exception of maybe the sidecar alternative, like none of those old things, especially like the cursor control stuff or the KVM things or whatever, they don't have. In theory, the polish that the Apple stuff supposedly has when everything is perfect and just right in a demo, but...
Luna Display! Thank you, Longform, in the chat. Sorry.
Yeah, Luna Display. There we go. We'll try to find a link for that. They don't have the polish that Apple stuff does in the best case, but a lot of times, as Underscore was discovering and Gruber was discovering with like the thing that does AirDrop, but does it in a way that actually always works reliably, you realize how finicky AirDrop is when you get a third-party app with no specific integration that you have to manually launch, but you know what? It just works every time. That kind of reliability has been absent from a lot of these services. So someone was just talking in another one of my Slacks about the ongoing inability of screen time to track the time that you spend on your devices. The thing that it's supposed to do, as Steve Jobs would say, well, why the F doesn't it do that? Right? Like, I know what it's supposed to do, but in practice, if you look at your screen time stats on all your different devices, A, they never agree with each other, and B, none of them match anything having to do with reality. Like, they might as well just be random numbers in bar charts. Like, and forget about like across like, oh, well, let me see what my screen times my kids have been using. I can tell you that never matched reality or across multiple devices either. Like, I think screen time is just a random number generator. It's just a bunch of random numbers and a bunch of bar charts based on those random numbers, because anybody who has ever tried to look at it and glean information and match it up with their experience of what they actually did with their device says, wait a second, A, these numbers don't match what I did, and B, they don't even add up. It doesn't make any sense. I wouldn't be surprised if it would say you had like 36 hours of screen time during a single day. Like, stuff like that. Like, you can roll out the feature and advertise it and put a name on it and have a screen on it, but like, if it doesn't actually work, people just start ignoring it and it just becomes noise. This is what I think about the invite apps too. It's like, it's good for Apple to have a first party app in its ecosystem to let people do invitations. It's bad for them to roll one out and then lose interest in it. So anyway, sorry, Steven, we couldn't help you more other than the chat room remembering Luna Display. There are third-party things that you can probably do some of this stuff in. I do not suggest signing with your Apple ID on your work computer. I know you want to. Everybody wants to. Don't do it.
Oh, actually, the chat room, who's this, Chris Nasso, also brings up Synergy, which I used to use ages ago.
There you go. That's the one I was thinking of. Is that, yeah. That predates Universal Control, I believe.
Oh, yeah. So this is, you know, using the same keyboard and mouse across multiple different devices. And they can be different platforms, the whole rigmarole. It works pretty well the last time I tried it, which, again, hasn't been for years. But that's another option if you wanted to do something that isn't quite as built in and seamless as
that doesn't
Universal
go to an
Control.
iPad, though, right? Because I'm assuming you can't even run Synergy on an
iPad. That might be true, actually. It was I think I only had used it with like full-on computers. Hello, Future Marco. Right. 136, maybe cut it here.
Yeah, I think
question mark?
This is good. All right.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. And we're doing the Sonos for the after show, right?
For overtime, yes, yeah. Sir.
Let me look at that. What were we?
The streaming box.
I think the main story is about the streaming box, and it's just a sad coda about the layoff. So I just say it's the streaming box thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Wildgrain, and Delete Me. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership, besides our exclusive content and other fun stuff, is ATP Overtime. This is a bonus topic every week. This week on Overtime, we're going to be doing some more Sonos discussion. There was an article that came out, I think, this morning or yesterday about Sonos. And they're codenamed Pinewood Video Player, which sounds like it might be a high-end competitor to the Apple TV. So that sounds really interesting. So we're going to talk about that in Overtime this week. You can join us at atv.fm/join to hear that and everything else membership gives you. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week. So,
Marco, I hear you had a productive weekend.
Yes. I am happy for more than one reason tonight. I am happy because I had the barbecue brisket earlier and it was delicious.
In part because you're here talking to your two best friends.
Yes, definitely that. Yes. that's true. Thank you. So three reasons. Okay. The third reason is that I spent this past weekend wiring the restaurant. And
oh, this is our first restaurant update, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. And more importantly, unwiring the restaurant. It's a small bar restaurant that is on Fire Island. Everything on Fire Island is kind of, you know, slapdash, you know, because you can't always get supplies, and it's, you kind of just got to deal with what you have, and everything is like small and old, and the environment is highly corrosive. Like, the air is salty from being near the ocean, and so it, like, nothing lasts, you know, there, and it's a very hostile environment for electronics and wires and things like that. This restaurant also sometimes, like on weekend nights, will have DJs come in and like plug into the sound system and really get it bumping late for late night bar business. I got in there and the DJ says the music system in general. You know, there's like regular speakers for playing music during, you know, regular, you know, dining hours, like, you know, small speakers, and then there's like the big DJ speakers. And. And I get in there and like I'm looking at this mess of wires. Oh, and of course, over time, the restaurant has had various point of sale systems, and so there's like, you know, various network wires running around. Every single network wire I see is like the thinnest of thin Cat 5e cable, where the ends are like a little bit pulling out of the connectors and like a little bit fraying, and I'm like, that's not amazing. And then the audio cables are just a massive, like, there's a thick bundle of cables running throughout the entire, like, running along the ceiling for half the restaurant, because, like, that's where the DJ cables plug in from across the way. But then, you know, over time, some cable would flake out or get static, or, you know, just the connectors would rust or whatever, or it would get crushed. And so the cable would kind of stop working, so they would just run another one. But because of the rule of audio systems, like once it works, don't touch it, nobody ever removed the old wires. So what I have inherited here is just an absolute mess of tons of wires everywhere, almost all of them what I would consider legacy wires. And there is a security camera system. There are 16 cameras. It's an old coax system.
Oh,
which means there are 16 wires. There's one for each camera, and they all go to like the main box, like the DVR thing that records them. And so there are these huge wire bundles, like just, and they're not running through the walls or anything. They're just like stapled to like zip tie mounts and running along the ceiling and, you know, collecting dust, and then they like turn and go into like a hole somewhere and then come out the other side. Like it's crazy. Because, you know, over time, this has been there for like 40 years. And over time, you know, when stuff breaks in a restaurant, you don't have a ton of time to like, let me look at Amazon and find the best option and order it and wait for it to arrive on the island, which could be a few days. Like, no, if something breaks in the middle of service, you kind of slapdash fix it however you possibly can because you don't have time. Like, so, and of course, in a restaurant where, you know, there's kind of no one in charge of wires, what happens then is that slapdash fix is just there forever. Like, it's never revisited. So I'm like, I get here. I had the DJ who's been there. He's a friend of mine. He's been DJing there for like 20 years. I had him come and like explain the system to me. And it's like this old, you know, this it's a rack. There's fortunately, you know, like a standard equipment rack, but it was, you know, full of DJ gear. There's like, you know, a little mixer and some a compressor and a limiter and a bunch of big DJ speaker amps and everything's just covered. Everything's covered in dust. So I'm like vacuuming out the stuff. The DJ comes, explains the system to me, and he's like, "Well, that doesn't work. That doesn't work." He's like, "But you got to be careful, because this is your business, not your home. And if it's your home, you'd be tempted to like buy all new stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like me. He's like, he's like, but here, you got to be careful with the business. You can't just do that because you'll eat into all your profit and you won't make any money. And I was like, that's good. Thank you. I'll try to have that self-control. Thank you. And he's like, all right, so you're going to be tempted to tear all this stuff out, but don't do it. I'm like, all right. So over the next half hour, he's walking me through the system. He's like, all right, here's what these speakers do. I would suggest replacing this subwoofer here. You should move this if you can. This wire, I strung this up 15 years ago for a temporary thing. We don't need it anymore. That one doesn't work anymore. That one doesn't work anymore. Within a half hour, he was saying, you know what? Replace it all. Gut it. Just tear it all out. Get all new stuff. Replace it all. So anyway, I'm in the process of replacing some of it, not all of it. But this past weekend was when I decided, let me tackle network wiring and any wires that are currently not in use. And I wanted to rewire. I wanted to run all new Cat 6A and Cat 6 wiring, all new throughout the place, get rid of all of the many old wires that are not in use. There's like old phone wires that aren't in use anymore. There's old coaxial cable wires that aren't in use anymore. Like, so many. I filled a garbage can, I filled a restaurant garbage can with wires that I had pulled out of the walls and down from the zip ties. And I must have cut 200 zip ties to take their wires down and replace them over the course of the weekend. Let me tell you, as a nerd, this was the most satisfying thing I think I've ever done, because it's like deleting code, but in real life. Like, just being able to take down old, crappy or obsolete or unused cables and replace huge wire bundles with one new wire that's the right length and high quality and have it just work. Oh, what a pleasure this has been.
Do you have the problem of where you remove the giant bundle of wires, the wall is a different color?
It's somewhat, yeah. Certainly there's a lot of small patchwork to be done now as a result of all this. But it looks a lot better than giant bundles of dusty wires that were there before. So, it's a trade-off for sure. But yeah, I'm having so much fun. There's a huge cable run that runs from where the TV system starts, behind the bar. And then the whole bunch of stuff runs around the side of the restaurant to where the DJs plug in and where there's another TV on the other side. And there's this big, thick bundle of nine cables that goes across that. And I think I have a way to convert those nine cables to zero cables. Everywhere else, I'm getting reductions. But this, I think I'm going to remove this entire thing. So I've known for a while, and this is going to get everybody writing in, I've known for a while there's a system called Dante for audio that basically routes audio signals over your network. So Dante adapters have XLR plugs on one end and a network hole on the other. And then you run this software that's Dante controller software on a computer somewhere, and that you can route things across the network. And all this time, I thought, I had heard about Dante audio systems, and I thought it was just for big, professional mixers installed in venues and stuff. But it turns out, I'm going to find out in a couple days. It turns out that you can just get a $200 adapter and run the apparently free software on a computer, and that's it. So that means I can run the audio signals from the DJ area over the network to the speaker amps and the mixer that are on the other side of the restaurant. So right now there are seven XLR cables that are snaked all over the restaurant, and I think I can run that over the network, which will mean there will be zero cables in a huge area where there used to be a lot, because I can just have a network drop down from the ceiling for that. So, oh man, I am having so much fun with deleting wires and deleting old brackets and mounts and running, of course, PoE powered as much as possible. So I'm getting rid of power adapters in a lot of places too. This is glorious. I know running a restaurant's going to be really hard, but this is I can do this part. This is my comfort zone. The rest of it, yeah, but also the rest of it, I have there are four people running this restaurant. So there's me, Tiff, manager, and assistant manager. So there's four people who can do the day-to-day operations. but I can do the wiring, and I'm really good at wires. So I'm so happy doing this stuff so far. And it's like I just figured out the Dante thing like yesterday. So I'm like, oh my God, now I can go back there and like delete five more wires, and especially like the five of the biggest wires. And so I'm gonna play with the stuff and see how it goes. But as like an area of tech, like, you know, I play with a lot of tech for myself, and some of it I have to like use for, quote, my work. You know, like when I get a microphone or sound gear to do podcasting, like I'm doing that for my work, right? But for the most part, I mostly don't apply tech to many applications besides tech for its own sake, or recording podcasts or programming. So when I have this opportunity now that I have an opportunity to apply tech and actually use it for like useful work that is not one of those areas that I've always been doing. It's very fulfilling. It's like, oh, I can fix this. Like, they've always complained that the Wi-Fi coverage in the restaurant was terrible because the way it's arranged, there's like the kitchen on one side, the dining room on the other, and between the kitchen and dining room are giant walk-in freezers and fridges, which are giant metal boxes. So there's almost no way to cover the entire area with one or even two access points. And, you know, they've been struggling because they weren't nerds like me, and they would just get whatever the POS vendor would give them, like some weird Cisco Meraki thing. And they, you know, it was never well placed because they're not experts in placing them, and they would never had enough of them because who knows why. So I get in there and I install.
Because expensive, that's why.
Well, and also, and they're told by, like, the tech person, oh, just stick one of these here. And that's, you know. So I get in there and I install a Ubiquiti system. Thank God. Thank Ubiquiti. Like, it is so nice and so easy and relatively inexpensive compared to other professional quality gear. Like, and I can put an AP wherever I want, and I can run these network drops, and I can have, like, you know, these PoE switches to power everything with like the one UPS in the rack that's powering all my APs and keeping them up. And then it's so much fun doing this part. I know the rest of it's going to be less fun in different ways, but this part is really freaking fun, and I'm really enjoying it.
That's awesome. No, I'm very excited, and I would love to see photos, even if you can't share them publicly. Sorry, everyone. I would love to see photos of everything when it's all installed. What's your timetable? When does the restaurant open for the summer?
We have like about a month before like a soft open. It's a soft open for St. Patrick's Day and then a full open in late April.
So. Oh, I didn't realize it was for my birthday. That's very kind of you. I didn't. Mm-hmm. Am I coming up for that?
Are you?
I don't think so, but thank you for offering. But please make sure you have plenty of green beer. No, that's super fun and super awesome. And, you know, it is, you said it just a moment ago, and it's so true. So much of what I do with my computer and with my home assistant tinkering is just to scratch an itch and just to give myself an outlet for my nervous energy. But it is just deeply satisfying when you can use your skills, which you've either honed professionally or because of, you know, your own hobbies or what have you, to actually improve something or someone's life. And it is such a satisfying thing. And we nerds, I would argue, we don't get it as often as we should. And it's so, so great to be able to have that moment. So I'm having a lot of fun living vicariously through you, at least for this part. Once once the summer rolls around, I'm not so sure I want to live vicariously through you anymore. But for now, it's very fun.
I'm even finding other areas. Like, I mean, you know, it turns out I have opinions about restaurants because I go to restaurants. So, you know, mm-hmm. I'm finding other areas that I'm able to, like, you know, provide some useful feedback or a good idea here and there. But, you know, like earlier today, I have to replace two coffee machines. I have to replace, like, a little espresso, like a Nespresso kind of pod maker because some of the cocktails, like, you know, espresso martinis, some cocktails use espresso. So I had to replace that, and I had to get a new one of those, like, big bun commercial, you know, coffee brewers for the back, mostly for staff. And, like, I knew, because, you know, the old one's broken, and the manager, quote, wants to throw it in the bay. So I said, all right, you can throw the old one in the bay, because the old one, the old coffee maker, is one of those that you see in every diner. It has, like, you know, the bun machine with the round hot plates that you put the coffee pots on after mm-hmm. they're brewed. And they mm-hmm. you have this big glass coffee carafes, you know, the orange ones for decaf, and, you know, those things. It's one of those. It looks like it's 100 years old. And I know from being a coffee nerd that when you have a hot plate keeping the coffee warm, it makes it taste horrific. And so I'm like, if we're replacing that, they make ones that have thermal carafes, which it just brews into like an insulated carafe that keeps the coffee warm by insulation, not by continuous heat. And so I asked the manager, I'm like, hey, you know, would this work for our needs? And they said yes. I'm like, great, I'll get a better coffee machine, like, because I know about coffee. Like, this is, and we're still going to have to get, like, food service pouches to go into it. Like, it's not going to be amazing beans, but it'll taste a lot less crappy than the ones that are sitting on the burners all night. So, yeah, I'm finding little areas that I can actually use my skills and expertise. And even though I don't know how to run a restaurant, I do know a lot about certain components of what it's going to take to run this. And because I am not doing this by myself, like, I'm part of a team of people doing this. And so I don't need to do everything for the restaurant. I can actually mostly just do the stuff I'm good at. And even, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're doing now is, you know, setup work. It's permits. It's paperwork. I'm about to be certified by the county health department to be a food manager. And I had to learn all sorts of stuff about food safety. A lot of that stuff I already knew because I'm a nerd. I listen to food safety podcasts sometimes, thanks to Dr. Don. a lot of the setup stuff, I know how to set up companies. I already had, because I have my own businesses. I knew how to get a sales tax certificate because my wife sells physical objects in New York State. And so we had to figure out the sales tax thing a couple years ago. Like, there's all these different components of my life that, like, I've done bits and pieces of this here and there. So I am able to bring some skill into this. I know how to do paperwork. I know how to set up things electronically. I know how to wire the place to have good Wi-Fi. I know how to wire the POS terminals so that they're reliable. Like, I know how to have a backup internet connection. Like, there's all these different things that, like, this is actually all useful information. And so I'm finding this surprisingly interesting and surprisingly engaging. And it's fun to have a project that, like, at the end of the day, like, I'm going to make this better in a way that not everybody will spot, but that will benefit a lot of people. And some people will appreciate it. And that is very fulfilling to me in a way that, like, I get that fulfillment with making software and making podcasts, but on a different level and in different ways. And this is a very new way to me to get that kind of fulfillment, to have, like, an in-person physical thing that, like, I'm helping to make this place even better, and I'm helping to keep this place going for what people like about it. And so it's a very interesting and fulfilling project, and I'm very happy to be working on it.
I just realized you more or less described the phenomenon of having a regular job. where you're working with other people in person, where your skills contribute to the overall success, and the things that you know how to do are valued and come in handy because that's why you're hired to do the thing. And, you know, it's novel for somebody who spent most of their career, like, self-employed doing computer stuff by themselves at home. But I think a lot of people listening to this would be like, yeah, you've got a job, you go to it, and you do stuff, and you use your skills. And
money
the other
comes
people
out.
Who work there, the other people who work there use their skills. And granted, you're the owner, and it's different, and so on and so forth. But, like, this is actually novel if you've spent your entire career as a self-employed software developer,
yes,
sitting in your house making apps.
Yeah, well, even, you know, simple stuff like I had to ask around, like, to our friends, like, what do I use to coordinate tasks with people?
really loud and point.
Right, like, you know, I know how to use, like, to-do apps for myself, and I know there's this entire universe of, like, collaboration platforms and collaboration apps, but I'm like, what should I use? And so I spent a few days trying out Notion and Basecamp and a couple other, like, you know, I looked at a couple other things, but, like, and we ended up just so far on Google Docs because our needs are pretty simple, but, like, that was a whole thing that used some of my tech experience and tech skills. Like, I actually know some names to look at here.
Big punch clocks things that you put a card into, it goes cha-chink.
Yeah.
Get one of those.
No, now the POSs all have built-in payroll tracking and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, there are certain things, like, when I was, you know, I replaced, so, oh, I forgot to end the DJ story. So DJ friend, he shows me the whole system, tells me at the end, yeah, you should probably replace it all. He leaves. I'm like, you know, let me at least like turn it on and see like what it sounds like and see how it works now based on what he told me. So I turn it on, and he had pointed to like the main mixer thing in the rack that, you know, that's how you set all the volume levels and pick the inputs. And he's like, that thing is full of short circuits. It's like 40 years old. You should probably replace that. I'm like, all right. So I go turn the system on. I connected. Actually, I had brought my old iPod that I have for my blimp speaker dock. I brought the iPod because I needed something that had a headphone output, and I like didn't like my phone. I didn't have the adapter for my phone, so I just grabbed that on the way out the door, forgetting for the moment that like my laptop had one. But I figured that out later. Anyway, so I plugged this iPod in, and I played some music, and I adjusted the volume. And the second I adjusted the volume, I heard a pop, and I never got it to work again.
No, that's good.
It's like I literally moved one volume slider on the mixer. And then, you know, cracked out, and I could never get the sound to come. Anything else I touched, I'm like, well, I guess I'm replacing that. And because I know sound, you know, I don't know DJ sound, but I do know sound. And so because the rack had contained like this 2U tall amp or a mixer thing with a bunch of slider, or no, I think it was 4U, this 4U mixer thing. And then it had a limiter, a compressor. That's two more rack units there, and there was one other thing. And I'm like, I looked around and I found there are these QSC zone mixers that do all of that stuff digitally and have all the inputs in the back. And so I just bought one of those, and now I have in one rack unit what was previously taking up like six or seven rack units. And it's even more full-featured and even better and can be remotely controlled from an iPad that we already have there for playing music anyway. So, like, I'm finding ways that my expertise is actually really coming in handy. And I still don't know anything about, like, how do we order food? How much food do we order? What food do we order? Like, those are hard questions. And I don't know anything about that. But you know what? I don't need to, because they do. Like the other staff members, they know how much food to order. You know who orders the food? The chef. Like, he knows how much food to order. The manager knows how much. Like, I don't need to know those things yet. I will eventually pick up some of that, I assume, or maybe not. Maybe I'm delegating to them for that stuff forever. But the Wi-Fi will be rock solid, and there will be way fewer wires.
Oh man, well, I'm excited. That should be very great. And that's the sort of thing that I would imagine, having never worked food service, that it will improve the quality of life, not only for customers, but for staff considerably. So even just silly things like, you know, better Wi-Fi can really make a tremendous difference. It, you know, it's not too different than us talking about wanting cellular Macs. You know, you're just having a strong and stable internet connection is really improves, and maybe this is ridiculous for me to say, but it improves my quality of life. You know, so much of what I do is related to things happening on the internet. So many of my friends, like you two, are on the internet, you know, if you will. So, no, having a solid connection, it makes so many things better for both sides of the house. All right, titles. I suggested Time and Smoke, but I do like that.
That is good. There was one in the middle. Let me see where it was. There's one in the middle I liked a lot. A Cheese Mite.
That is pretty good, actually. I could do either of those.
They're really cute.
I'm sure.
Small and translucent. They're on your cheese. You eat them. It's great. Maybe not
Lovely.
On Casey's cheese.
Hospital
environment for cheese mites.
Yes. I like Time and Smoke more, but I can do a Cheese Mite. I would not complain about Cheese Mite.
I like Cheese Mite a little more.
Where is the actual Cheese Mite title? I don't see it.
It's a Two. Cheese Mite.
Hmm. I'd be good with either. You know, I lightly prefer Time and Smoke, but I would totally be fine with Cheese Mite.
Time and Smoke is a better title than the Cheese Mite one. But it's that's like a pre-show title. It's a really, really early one.
You tell me what you want. I'll do either.
Let me see what else is in here.
Between those two, I didn't give you other options. Come on now.
I'm looking through the whole list here.
Let's see. I think there are some other decent ones, but I think those two are the clear standouts to me.
I like Time and Smoke better.
All right, then that wins. Okay.
Time and smoke. All right.
Cool.
Ready
All right.
to rock.
We're going into overtime, so thank you, live people. We're going to cut you off now and keep the
same time
around.
Next week, right?
I think
yes.
Yes.
Same time next week.
Yep. Cool. All right. Thanks, live people. We'll see you later.